look around the back of that upstairs storage closet or in that stuff drawer in your kitchen, maybe the top shelf of a child's bedroom, I bet there's a collection of objects that make you shake your head and say, oh, the stories I could tell. Well, now there's a place where at least some of those stories might just be told. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, and I'm here with Kansas City actor and writer and producer David Wayne Reed. Hello, David.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here, and I want to talk about this project. What is Shelf Life?
Well, Shelf Life is the name of my storytelling series. It's a bi-monthly series. It's going to be starting up at the Brick, and it's like The Moth meets Antiques Roadshow.
All right.
If you're familiar with either of those. Well, it's really like show and tell for adults.
Who doesn't love a metaphor that involves public radio and public television in the same sentence?
Oh, right. I know my crowd.
Why? Well, let's talk about each of those shows and sort of how you bring them together, actually. Why do you think people like storytelling? Why has The Moth become such a thing?
Well, because I think it provides a sense of community. You know, I think we're so heavily inundated with our social media that we really forget the object of actually telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
We have this idea of narratives, you know, that's corporate speak. You know, that's storytelling has kind of been appropriated by the corporate world.
Right.
And so it's become something that it's really no longer. And I think this is a great way to return to the authenticity of a human interaction. And I think that's why The Moth and This American Life are so successful. It's first-person accounts, and people find a lot of universal themes in very personal experiences.
Okay, now that makes a lot of sense to me, but Antiques Roadshow seems like it would appeal to an entirely different sensibility.
Well, perhaps. I think that, like you said in your nice intro, there's a lot of stories behind our objects. Recently, I cleaned out my aunt's estate. She deceased and had lived there with my grandmother and my other aunt, and there was just a house full of boxes of so much stuff. It's unimaginable. And as my mother and I would go through it, we would stop. You know, we want to get through it and sort through it, but you'd see an object and it would bring up a new story. And, you know, we all have those objects. And behind those objects, we all have those stories. And I find that the objects are just kind of a totem or a lens with which to open up a broader story.
Yeah. I was not too long ago, my family is cleaning out my grandmother's house. She is still living, but she has moved to a retirement community, and the house is full of boxes right now of a lot of those objects. And what was interesting to me is I found it wasn't the boxes of figurines, the things that she was saving. That wasn't as interesting to me as, frankly, the sugar bowl that I remember sitting on her dining room table for the last 40 years.
Right. No, I snapped up the cookie jar that I grabbed way too many cookies out of when
right.
I was a kid at grandma's house.
Right.
You know, those very specific memories, it opens up a whole new world and a lot of latent memories that we haven't thought of in 30, 40, you know, maybe even longer.
So what, it was cleaning out your aunt's house that gave you the idea for this?
It was. I've always been a part of the storytelling community in Kansas City, and it just seemed like a natural fit to return to, you know, the childhood game of show and tell, but kind of give it a modern update. You know, that's kind mm-hmm. of my tagline, Shelf Life, a modern show and telling. So really taking a child's game and turning it on its ear.
What is it you think? I mean, we're talking about how possessions trigger stories. Is it about the relationships behind the possessions, or is there something about the tactile? What is it about the possessions, the objects, that does this?
Well, I think that's individual to each person. You know, some in the way that we might view a painting, some of us, the color red might take us somewhere, the texture or the memory. I think there are many entry points into many different stories from an object.
Can you think, I know you're going to tell us a story in a little bit here, but can you think of examples of objects that had this impact on you, maybe when you were cleaning your aunt's house?
You know, yes, there was a small antique carnival glass holder that held all the spoons, and it sat in the middle of my grandma's dining room table, which we always went over there Sundays after church, and we'd all grab our spoons out of this jar, and I really wanted that jar.
And
put on my own table, right?
And is that where it is now?
It is.
That's great.
It actually holds my pens and my scissors and my office supplies, but those are my tools.
You don't have as much need for spoons.
Right. Well, yeah. I'm a fork person.
Okay, well, that's fair. I appreciate that. It's funny, you use this tagline, show and tell. Show and tell evokes children. It evokes grade school. Is there something about this that also taps into, I don't know, a youthfulness in us?
Well, I think so. I think that we all, you know, you go to any of your friends' houses that have children, the children always want to come out and they want to show you what they have. Mm-hmm. And it's a way of hosting, but it's also a way of entertaining and showing you a little bit of part of themselves. And I think that children, they don't have the social constructs that we adopt as we get older. And I think that is our primal desire to share our stuff and share our stories. Yeah. And so I'm kind of lifting that from the kiddos.
Well, very good. I want to give you a chance to tell one of these stories. And this is actually a story that people who come to the Brick this Saturday at 7 can actually hear for themselves, right?
Yes. This Saturday, all of my shows are curated by theme. And so my opening show is around the theme of winning. Objects and stories related to winning. And my story is about winning in a company chili cook-off.
And I see you actually have an object here with you. Will you be holding this while you deliver the story to the audience?
You know, I have a special shelf that has been built for shelf life.
Wow.
And so everyone will bring their objects and place those on the shelf and then tell their stories.
Okay. So if we were sitting there, we would see this object on a shelf. Can you describe it for our listeners?
Yes. This is my prison grade reward that I received for winning two chili cook-offs. It's two plastic spoons that I think were probably bought at the Dollar Tree.
Clear plastic spoons, not terribly grand.
And they had a paint pen marked my winning, that I was the chili cook-off champion. However, it's been so many years that the actual acknowledgement of the award has faded off and been washed off. But I still have my ribbon. It says grand prize and a kind of Olympian red, white, and blue neck lanyard.
You're holding them with a certain reverence, befitting their lofty status as awards, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, because the chili cook-off's coming back again, so I'm in it to win it. I'm planning on winning again.
Well, let's hear the story that will go with these spoons. This is David Wayne Reed.
Sure, thank you. It's called The Secret Ingredient. I earned a reputation for being a horrible cook when I showed up to a lake party with a dish that was comprised of orzo, chipped beef, and pickled okra. This dish set a new bar for culinary lows and earned me both ridicule and pity. Upon invitation to dinner parties, I'd ask what I could bring, to which host would almost uniformly answer, why don't you just bring a bag of ice? Sure, I could have stopped then. I could have accepted defeat and turned away from my chefly desires. But rather, this failure only fueled my ambition. My mantra became, I will cook and you will taste my success. I began in earnest by first perfecting my mother's hash brown casserole recipe. I began to take it to parties where friends tasted my casserole with understandable caution, but then they were so surprised with delight that they even asked me to bring it to future gatherings. I became sought out for this casserole in the same way that my sister is for her deviled eggs, which she prefers to call angel eggs, but I digress. See, I'm not one to rest on laurels. I wanted to branch out with my cooking, to really achieve, and to maybe even earn public accolades. So when Ashley, our billing supervisor at work, proposed a chili cook-off, I simply said, bring it. The chili cook-off awakened a competitive nature I had let lay dormant for way too long. Like a long-distance runner, I began to prepare. I bought a new crock pot specifically for the event, in the same way one might buy new running shoes, thinking that the shoes will make you run faster or jump higher. But this is where my preparation stopped. I didn't really refine my recipe. Besides the basics of meat and beans, I just threw ingredients into the new crock pot in the same willy-nilly manner I had with my earlier failure of the dish selection. Here, my selection was based on availability rather than recipe. I threw in bacon, corn, fried cranberries, coffee grounds, orange juice, chipotle peppers, maple syrup. I just hoped for the best, just tasting, stirring, simmering, and steeping. On the day of the cook-off, we numbered our chilies while checking out the other competition. There was a white chicken chili, a barbecue bratwurst chili, a jerk chili, a chili that sat in a 1970s-era maroon crock pot that had a label that read Farter Starter. I wrote this one off as no competition. As my coworkers gather and sample all of the chilies, we write down the number of our favorite chili on a piece of recycled copy paper. My boss, a staunch vegetarian, even exclaims that she tried my meaty chili. She says, when it's gourmet, I'll make the sacrifice. And so, the votes are counted, and my number, number two, ironically, comes in with the most votes, and I'm awarded a large plastic spoon that has First Annual Chili Cook-Off Champion written in paint pen. I pull down my fist and say yes and gloat for the rest of the afternoon. Smell that, Ashley. Ashley complains intermittently about my cook-off when. He makes offhanded remarks only when there's a crowd around. He says, who puts cranberries in their chili? He mocks me and says, coffee and chili? That's just not right. It's un-American, he says. And each time he brings it up, I recognize that my success eats at him. And I like this. Some months later, we're both at a work conference in Reno, Nevada, and there's an annual fundraiser and raffle, and this year you can win a Wi-Fi or travel vouchers or a large television. I buy some raffle tickets, and I ask Ashley if he's bought his. Nah, he says, I don't play lotteries. I'll save my money. And with that said, I turn around and buy five more raffle tickets. Those last five raffle tickets end up winning me a 50-inch flat-screen television that I win in a raffle in Reno. I can tell that this bristles my coworkers in the same way as my chili win, but I enthuse regardless. Is it really up to me to feel bad about winning just because someone else has hurt feelings? To me, the only thing worse than being a sore loser is being a humble winner. In fact, when my winning number is called, I jump up in the air, I hoot, I holler, and I run to the stage as if I'm on Price is Right. It seems ungrateful to not do so. There are smiles and congratulations, but I can also sense a change in tide. It's the whisper of resentment. The next month, the whisper becomes a full-on scream when I win the chili cook-off for the second year in a row. I can see Ashley's blood boil as his face turns the color of his smoked spare rib chili. I'm enthusiastic about it, but still disbelieving. I feel like Sally Field when she accepted her Oscar, saying, "You like me! You really like me!" And I'm awarded another plastic championship spoon for the popular vote, even though I only win by one vote. Coworkers ask me what my secret ingredient was. And I say, this year, I used chocolate. Some say, interesting. Or others say, well, it was good regardless. Ashley finally says, come on, who the hell puts chocolate in chili? And I say, people who win chili cook-offs, Ashley. This sends Ashley over the edge. Our coworker verifies that the second time that I won, it was like opening up an old wound and then pouring salt on it. Ashley tried to play it off, but I knew that it got to him. And she says that apparently it was painful for his whole carpool as well. I think of him on his ride home to Lee Summit, stewing angrily while the lid on his crockpot rattles nervously in the back seat. Jean, who's a part of his carpool, pulls me aside one day and says, maybe you could just sit out the next chili cook-off, please? As if. I'm a winner, and winners never quit.
That's David Wayne Reed reading his story, The Secret Ingredient. You get to hear that story this Saturday at The Brick. That's at 1727 McGee. Doors open at 7. The show's at 7:30. The first in his Shelf Life series that David's putting together. How many more of these will there be, David?
Well, it's a bi-monthly series, so six in my first year. We have Winning, Election Season, The Gift, Idol Worship, Wanderlust, and Cotton as the themes for the first year program.
Cotton.
Yes.
Interesting. Where do you find the people to tell these stories?
I listen. I listen a lot. I know people, and I'm also I have open submissions. People can send their pictures of their ideas, their objects, and their stories to yourshelflife@gmail.com, or find me on Facebook.
Okay, well, that's an open invitation there. How many storytellers will there be this Saturday night?
There's actually 7. I'm going to try to do only 6, but I just happen to know a lot of winners, I guess.
You're going to vote someone off between now and then?
We'll see. We'll see what happens.
I know you got an Arts KC inspiration grant for this.
Yes.
What is it that the Arts Council is seeing here and trying to cultivate, do you think?
Well, I think that they supported my project because it was a startup series that really helps invigorate our arts community. It gives regular programming, and it really kind of democratizes the performance aspect. There are a lot of great stories out there that aren't necessarily coming from professional actors or writers or storytellers. And so I really want to open up the platform to include all of those voices.
If people can't make it to these shows, there's something about live storytelling that's great, but will they have access to the stories some other way?
Yes. I'm building a website, and you'll be able to click on a picture of the object and hear the story.
All right. And do you know the website name right now?
I think it's shelflife.club. And it will be debuting in November.
All right. Well, very good. Well, that's David Wayne Reed. He's a writer and producer and actor and a man about town. And he shared a story with us today. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Brian, for having me. Always a pleasure.
It was great to have you. You can find our program online. You can find out more about this and other shows we've done recently, too. It's all going to be up there later this afternoon at kcur.org/Central Standard. Are you on Twitter? We certainly are. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at PTS Brian. Follow us there. Tomorrow, what happens when college students from different places and backgrounds are thrown together in a dorm room? The joys and the nightmares of the freshman experience. That's tomorrow here on Central Standard. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Our team includes Suzanne Hogan, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope, along with intern Zach Klammen. Gina Kaufman's on leave. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll see you tomorrow.